This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
Day two, government shutdown 2013. This time, however, we were prepared. The top 100 single from 1995, Coolio's Gangsta's Paradise. 1995, the last time the government shut down. Back then, it was a crisis, uncharted waters for the federal government, unclear protocols. But thanks to Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton, today there are detailed plans and contingencies in Washington. We are so good at shutting down the government. We've had practice, and we're apparently going to get better at it. A dear friend of mine, who until recently actually ran the Office of Personnel Management for the federal government in D.C. and is a veteran of the 1995 days, knows all about those plans. But he's been appointed ambassador to Australia recently, and last night he emailed me gently to say he was quite happy to be 14,000 miles away from D.C. on this week. But our next guest, Sally Katzen, knows the process very well. She was part of the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget team, that prepared for the last government shutdown during the Clinton administration in 1995, 1996. She joins us from Washington, D.C. Sally, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
How was the government prepared in 1995, and how do you think the experience of 1995 informs what's been going on this week?
Well, the mechanics are essentially the same. We saw it coming. There was a dispute between the Congress and the president as to budget issues, and we had been presented with a bill that had a lot of riders on it. That's technical terms for policy positions attached to the money bill that were unpalatable, and the president threatened to veto, and if he did, there would be no funds to continue the government. And we knew he was going to do this. So we saw it coming. We were able to make some plans. We were able to decide who was accepted. I think the term now is essential, and who regrettably was not. And then we moved into implementation. So the As you say, the game plan, although this is not a game, was set, and it was easy, relatively, although painful, to put it in motion. There are, however, very significant differences between the 95-96 shutdown, and that was plural. There were two of them, than the current situation.
And we'll talk about those differences in a second. Let's continue down memory lanes here a little bit and remember just what it was like and how really shocked President Clinton was speaking about the government shutdown in December of 1995. Listen.
The Congress has refused to pass legislation that would keep the federal government open to serve the American people. This has never happened before for this length of time in the whole history of the Republic. And it's been very hard on 750,000 public servants who have to pay rent and utilities and mortgage payments and buy food.
Now there's more than 750,000 public servants who are affected by this shutdown. The president there sounds very, very frustrated. But at that moment that you were engaging this process, was there any precedent at all? Was there any orderly kind of procedure that you could go to, you know, in case of government shutdown, break glass, that sort of thing?
No, we had some anecdotal information available to us, but we were essentially trying to deal with things as they materialized. And one of the problems was the uncertainty as to how long it would take. It's one thing to plan a shutdown for a couple of days. It's something else if you know it's going to be a couple of months. There isn't a business in this country that would accept the parameters of absence of planning for their operations, and yet that's what we were presented with, not only from the management of the process, but the people who were affected, who were home, didn't know whether they would be home for one day, one week, one month, and that uncertainty has an incredibly destructive quality to it.
I want to talk about that in just a second. As people were sitting at home with that uncertainty, this was the extent of the process that they were able to observe. Here's Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich talking to the press about how he apparently was going to help get the government out of this mess back in 1995.
Well, let me just say, I think the minute we have a budget agreement that we should be able to get something through the House within hours that would take care of all the current problems. The Negotiations will begin tomorrow. I think we should meet every day as long as we need to each day until we get it done.
And there, Newt Gingrich is really pointing out one of the differences inadvertently between 1995 and today. There really aren't negotiations going on today, and there's not as clear a set of arguments today as there was in 1995 or a set of issues. Would you agree with that?
I definitely would agree with that. First, there are no negotiations, and second, the issue is much more complicated. From what you can see in the news media, the issue is less about budget than about health care. And the irony is that shutting down the government does not dramatically affect the rollout of the health care law. So you have a disconnect there, and that creates frustrations that are very, very difficult to handle. There's also a different economic context, and this is important. In 1995, 1996, we had a very healthy, robust economy. We are now in the midst of a fragile recovery, and the actions to shut down the government today follow on a sequester that has been in effect for the summer that has led these same employees who are being shut out of their offices today to have taken 4, 5, 7, 8 days of unpaid leave during the summer.
That's the first time I've heard anyone say that, and that's crucial to remind people. We're talking with Sally Katzen, senior advisor at the Podesta Group, visiting professor at NYU Law School. She was an administrator at the Office of Management and Budget during the 1995-1996 government shutdown. There's an Article 1 of the Constitution, which is all about Congress, and there's an Article 2 of the Constitution, which is all about the executive branch. Does this play, or did it back in 1995, play as one part of government against another, the Congress essentially doing something to inflict pain, literal pain, on the executive?
I don't think we saw it that way. I think that we appreciated that there were deeply held different views and that some common ground had to be found. We thought that the shutting of the government was an inappropriate action to take to realize their ambitions or objectives, however you might put it. But I think it's less a separation of powers and constitutional argument. The House has the power of the purse. Congress allocates the funds. The president executes the law. That assumes you want the government to function. That assumption may not hold today. And we're faced – the other difference, I think, that is important to note is that in 95, with the first shutdown, which lasted only 5 days, there were already 3 appropriations bills that had been passed and signed by the president, military construction, agriculture, and water and energy. But by the time the second shutdown came in December, this was the one that lasted 20-some days, there were 4 more appropriations bills that had been passed: defense, transportation, Treasury Postal, and of course the legislative branch. That meant that for those departments, they were unaffected by the shutdown. So we had about half of a shutdown. Now we have a whole shutdown.
Totally
working.
And
that's a big difference.
We're totally working without a net this time around. Sally Katzen, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Sally Katzen is the senior advisor at the Podesta Group, a visiting professor at NYU Law School, administrator at the Office of Management and Budget during the 1995's government shutdowns. So what's going on here? All of the colorful metaphors.
This is Jay from Leicestertown, Maryland, and I think the government shutdown is a sign of dysfunction. Our lawmakers are behaving like petulant children, and the American people are paying the price.
Thank you, Jade, and we are happy to hear more colorful metaphors about all of this at 877-8-MY-TAKE. But what is going on here? The American system provides for open-ended debate and the consideration of minority views on issues. It's one of the distinctive features of U.S. democracy. But has that system of checks and balances, advice and consent been corrupted by what's going on here?
This is Chase Robinson calling from Austin, Texas. And I don't see how anyone can view the situation as anything but an example of government dysfunction. Whether or not you agree with the goals of either side, we can all agree, I think, that this form of governance by crisis is inefficient in the extreme.
This is Cameron calling from Livermore, California. This is a great example of systemic failure of what we call democracy. Incessant partisan lockstepping for fear that if one does not vote with the party, one's party's corporate backers won't pay for one's reelection. You couldn't impede human progress more effectively if you tried.
So dysfunction, you say. This is not some chaotic celebration of differing views. As you say in Salt Lake City, Utah, the government shutdown is a clear sign of a broken system. When the whole government comes to a stop over a single issue, one must question both parties' inability to compromise and what their true motivations really are. You know, an overwhelming number of you wrote to vent your frustrations like this with Congress. But there were a few, it ain't pretty, but we're learning we can do without Washington views as well.
Robin Shaw, Ludlow, Kentucky. And I think that people should remember that all the federal employees that are currently getting the day off without pay, or however long it may be, they are non-essential personnel. And people should remember that that is exactly what it sounds like. It's non-essential. Shouldn't be there anyway.
Glenn Simpson. I just say let them fight it out. Heck, the USA, man, we're the greatest country in the world. We'll get it done.
Ah, maybe a reality show, wrestling with the lawmakers, eh, Doug? Al Sullivan wrote this on Facebook. The system is designed to make dramatic change hard to do. This same system prevented many of the worst proposed abuses of the Bush administration. Now the shoe is on the other foot, and Democrats are up in arms. The Tea Party are selfish, arrogant, ignorant people, but they have a right to work the system like anybody else. Very thoughtful comment there, Al. Later this hour, we're going to look at this tension between minority and majority in our constitutional democracy. But take our poll at thetakeaway.org. Who's at fault here? As of earlier today, 83% of you found the Republicans at fault, 4% for the Democrats, 5% blame Obama, 8% say everyone is to blame for the shutdown. Go to thetakeaway.org to tell us what you think. It's not a scientific poll, but you'll be interested in the results. And Tom from Seattle reminds us that maybe there's a limited incentive for our representatives up on Capitol Hill to do anything at all about this.
Just a reminder that all those members of Congress are getting paid during the government shutdown.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation. Stay tuned for our thoughtful discussion later this hour. And find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
To Syria now, where the hard work of diplomacy last week has this week become the tangible dismantling of Syrian chemical weapons. Instead of negotiators, it is a team of inspectors, engineers, chemists, and paramedics who began to gather in Damascus yesterday and will fan out across the country in the coming weeks. Last week's United Nations resolution orders all of the chemical production and mixing plants confiscated or destroyed in Syria by November 1st. Michael Lujan is the spokesman for the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which is running the whole operation. He joins me now from The Hague in the Netherlands. Michael, welcome.
Good morning, John.
Can you describe to me the unique circumstances that your dismantlers, your engineers, chemists, and paramedics face doing this in Syria as opposed to doing it in some arms depot in Kazakhstan?
Just about everything. Just the environment itself, the 35 to 40 degree daytime temperatures when our inspectors are going to be out visiting these sites. You know, they have to wear chemical protection gear. On top of that, they're going to have to wear flak jackets and helmets. It's going to be absolutely brutal. And, of course, there's the security dimension. This is really terra incognita for this organization. This is a volunteer assignment. All of our inspectors who have signed up for this this work of visiting these sites and inspecting their contents are doing this on a voluntary basis. This isn't a come-what-may assignment. I can say that the attitude and the spirit here is very good. It's upbeat. Our guys are loose. And I think there's a palpable sense that we can get this done.
You know, when you say volunteer, they're getting paid, but this is not an assignment that they're being ordered into this battle zone, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, okay.
That's correct.
Just want to clear that up. But again, remarkable courage on the part of these individuals. Now, the one thing you have going for you, it seems to me, is that these weapons are presumed to be in good working order. They're not sitting around in rusting, you know, 55-gallon drums, that sort of thing. So if you can get your hands on them and keep from being shot at, tell me about the disposal process. They go from arms depot into some disposal unit immediately, or they go into some truck? What happens?
Well, we will know that at the end of this month. That's the purpose of this slate of inspections we're going to be doing for the next 30 days. We have to get out and get into those sites. All we know right now is on paper and what's been given to us by the Syrian government. We have to verify that what's on paper exists in reality. And in the process of doing that, we'll also see the kind of conditions that these chemical weapons and chemical weapons-related materials are in. But as you suggested, once we get into the destruction phase, there will be a variety of technological options that we'll be considering that will be on the table. In some cases, it might be mobile facilities where we will use neutralization to detoxify the chemical weapons agents like sarin and sulfur mustard. Other cases might require a detonation chamber, so you blow up munitions in a safe environmental manner. Other places might be using incineration. And in some cases, the door has been left open to the possibility of having to move some of this stuff out of Syria.
Now, the Syrians...
We'll know that when we get there.
Right, right. Now, the Syrians insist that they're being, you know, cooperative here. Here's Bouthania Shaban, who's a political and media advisor to Syrian President Bashar Assad, speaking yesterday.
Forcing the Syrian government or making sure that the Syrian government, all this rhetoric in order to show as if Syria is not the one who wanted to do this. And this proves that the Syrian government would never use such a weapon.
What is your expectation of cooperation among Syrian officials?
Well, we know that feelings within Syria about this whole mission, this enterprise of disarming the Syrian government of its chemical weapons, feelings are running extremely high on both sides. We're trying to operate in the middle. And what we're going to judge the government by is what they do on a day-to-day basis. What we can say to this point is that we've had a very business-like and efficient relationship with them, and they've done everything that's been expected of them and needed from them to this point to make us operational.
What is a mixing plant? The UN resolution says mixing plants need to be confiscated or destroyed. Rooms that contain precursors?
Yeah, what's known from open sources about the composition of Syria's chemical weapons program is that it includes large quantities of sarin gas that, for the most part, is stored separately from munitions. And it's stored in the two component precursor chemicals that, when they are blended together, make the sarin, which then is loaded into munitions that are designed for that purpose. Mm. And that's what we're going to be aiming at. And at the same time as conducting these verification missions to determine what's there is what's on paper, we're also going to be disabling, if not entirely destroying, but rendering inoperable the entire chemical weapons-making apparatus of the Syrian government and taking these mixing and filling machines, equipment, taking that off the table so that as we go forward to destroy the existing stockpile, no more chemical weapons will be possible to be made.
Michael Lujan, in the minute before we go, I've looked at the map of Syria. Perhaps a third of the sites that you're going to be going into are actually in combat zones, literal firing zones. Presuming that inspectors, engineers, chemists, and paramedics can get jobs virtually anywhere in the world, why do your people do this?
Well, they do it because they believe that, first of all, this mission is it's historic. This has never been done before, disarming a country of a category of weapons of mass destruction in the midst of war. But beyond that, there's also an understanding that if we can do this and we can do it in a fair and impartial way, that this might also be the catalyst for a renewed peace process that could actually bring some sort of civil end to this horrible conflict. And that's something that's extremely inspiring for all of us.
Yeah, well, heroes, how many on this team?
The setting up team that's in Damascus now is about 20, and we will be deploying, rotating in and out of Syria, successive waves of teams of 15 to 20 inspectors.
Heroes.
That's the group size that we work in.
Michael Lujan is spokesman for the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons on the teams in Syria to dismantle those weapons of the Bashar al-Assad government. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Hey there. You're looking pretty sporty in your new Vibram soles and colorful Gore-Tex there. Ready for a rock climb? Did any of you visit Google.com yesterday? If you did, you might have noticed it was the 123rd anniversary of Yosemite National Park, and for a birthday gift, as we've been discussing, Yosemite, along with the entire 84.4 million acres that make up the national park system, closed down due to our government shutdown here. From the Grand Canyon to the Statue of Liberty to the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park and Preserve in Alaska, all of them remain closed. So what you going to do with those hiking boots? Many of the 280 million people who visit the parks each year are being forced to modify some of their plans. Among these tourists is Marty Puckridge of Australia. Hey, Marty.
Morning, John.
You got some nice new hiking boots and Patagonia duds that you're dying to get out on the mountains?
Absolutely. I came over here specifically to visit the Yosemite National Park and Joshua Tree, and then perhaps head over to Boulder, Colorado, for some more rock climbing over there. I've got October off, so the timing has been, shall we say, inconvenient.
Well, you know, you can't actually close a mountain. I mean, can they keep you out, or can they really keep you out if you, you know, sort of sneak into the park somehow and just climb?
I think they've definitely done their best to shut the gates. I think you could obviously access the park from a different point if you wanted to. The problem with that is that if something goes wrong, the consequences sort of go exponentially higher, you know.
That's rescue.
The real danger. No rescue or delayed rescue in the event of kind of having to find someone with a key to the gates.
More of an Aussie-style adventure, though, to tell your friends back home, but not necessarily something you'd want to do.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So how are you modifying your plans?
So at this stage, I'm tossing up actually between flying down to Mexico. There's some great rock climbing in Mexico, or back up to Squamish, to Canada. I was in Toronto earlier.
Really? So you're just going to bail on the U.S. altogether?
It's looking like it. I can't really sort of sit here and wait this out, just hoping that the parks will open again. The only sort of precedent that I can find online seems to be that it can last for weeks, this kind of shutdown. So, so unless I just want to kind of go to climbing gyms around the Bay Area.
Oh, what fun. What fun. You know, you're in San Francisco, right?
I am, yeah.
Yeah, you could go to the Apple store. That's cool.
Yeah, exactly. Do the tour, the Silicon Valley tour. Yeah. But it's not kind of the rock climbing tour that I was hoping for.
And go to the Genius Bar, you know, and see some live music. Mm-hmm. Man, you know, I just have to say, as an American, I'm personally really sorry that you've come here and your experience is just kind of ruined.
Well, yeah, it's a bit disappointing. Obviously, the parks are going nowhere. That's the kind of upside. I will always be here.
Well, we hope that you come back when we're not having a government shutdown. Marty Puckridge, thanks so much.
No, thanks, John.
Marty Puckridge's rock climbing vacation derailed by our government shutdown. A tourist from Australia. He's hanging out in San Francisco right now, but considering Mexico or Canada, kind of like the rest of America.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Given up on America yet? You might be excused for escaping to New Zealand this week, but there's no way to escape the U.S. government, as several hundred people have learned doing their taxes overseas in the past few years. And it's about to get worse. The Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, otherwise known as FACTA, the law was passed in 2010, takes effect in July of 2014, and requires all financial institutions around the world to report to the IRS the earnings and assets of American citizens abroad. The law was supposed to crack down on tax evasion and offshore tax havens, but it has had the effect of convincing hundreds of the some 6 million Americans abroad to turn in their passports, to just bag U.S. citizenship altogether. Ruth Freeborn, who lives in Canada, is one of those people. And Jackie Bunyan is an advisor to people like Ruth. She's the head of the American Citizens Abroad Tax Advocacy Chapter in Geneva, Switzerland.
The situation has become extremely complicated and tense for Americans overseas recently. First of all, we're subject to citizenship-based taxation, which means we have to file taxes not only in the country where we live, which is normal, but also to the United States. Then on top of this citizenship-based taxation, the FATCA law was passed in 2010. Now, the purpose of FATCA was to go after tax evasion. This makes sense for accounts where Americans are resident in the United States and are hiding money and really evading taxes through accounts overseas. But for Americans overseas, those foreign bank accounts are their local bank accounts. And what is happening now is because of the perceived threat and legal threat recognized by the foreign financial institutions, they are just deciding that it's easier to eliminate Americans as clients. And it's become a major, major, major problem.
All right. Well, Jackie Bunyan, hold on right there. Let's get a reality check from Ruth Freeborn. Now, did your financial institutions, Ruth, in Canada, seem pretty annoyed by having to do this paperwork because of the FATCA law?
It's not just the paperwork. I actually wrote to the Canadian Bankers Association, and it's the cost to the banks to implement this with actually no benefit to Canada whatsoever. And most Americans in Canada would never owe any tax to the United States. It's just a lot of hoop jumping and very expensive for low and middle income expats to comply with.
All right. Well, Ruth, let me ask you. I mean, I gather your American citizenship was worth something to you emotionally or otherwise.
It was worth a lot to me.
Yeah.
And I still feel... You know, I'm very grateful to the United States for my childhood and upbringing there. I have no animosity towards the United States.
But did the FACTA law make you feel like the U.S. government didn't trust you?
It made me feel that I was being lumped in with criminal drug lords and money launderers. And not only that, I was a stay-at-home mom. I don't have any income. They wanted me to our bank to report on my foreign spouse's income. He's Canadian. He's never lived or worked in the United States. He's supported myself. And he objected strongly to having that kind of data turned over to the United States when he's never been a citizen there. It just became almost impossible for me to keep my American citizenship. I became a liability to my family, and it was not a decision I took lightly at all. But I felt that I was being put in a position to choose between my Canadian family here and my country of birth.
So this is not an outrageous, unusual story from your perspective, Jackie Bunyan.
It's not an unusual story, but I'm still outraged that the U.S. government is creating laws that are forcing its citizens to renounce their citizenship. Taxes should not be associated with citizenship. Taxes should be associated with where you reside. That's where you get government services.
Well, Jackie Bunyan and Ruth Freeborn, I'm a little envious of both of you. You know why?
No.
Well, you both are in countries that actually have a functioning government there in Canada and Switzerland.
Yes,
well,
that's true.
Well, I hope that in the future it will get back on the rails, but I think that right now it's gone off the deep end.
And feeling pretty good about that Canadian passport today, Ruth?
I'm very grateful to Canada. Yes, I am.
Ruth Freeborn, 55-year-old American living in Canada who recently relinquished her American citizenship because of onerous tax regulations. And Jackie Bougnon, tax team director at American Citizens Abroad in Geneva. That's a nonprofit advocacy group for American expatriates. Jackie and Ruth, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
A decade ago, you may recall, Valerie Plame and her husband Joe Wilson, she a CIA agent and he a retired ambassador with the State Department, got in political trouble, suggesting that the Bush rationale for the invasion of Iraq was based on intelligence that was essentially fiction. They turned out to be right. Plame's undercover identity was revealed by Washington Post journalist Robert Novak. Her career in the CIA was over. Her husband became a consultant, and the couple retired to New Mexico, where they live today. But from accusing others of fictional intelligence, Plame today has made the jump to writing fiction about the CIA. Her new book, Blowback, co-written with Sarah Lovett, opens with the discovery that Iran is on the verge of making a nuclear bomb.
In my work at the CIA, my expertise was in nuclear proliferation. Nothing is more important than this nexus of nuclear weapons and terrorism. And so that's at the heart of the story.
What do you make of the whole WMD debate that came out of the whole Syria crisis that's now, you know, been punted back to the United Nations? The use of chemical weapons, the question of intelligence. There's a chemical weapons team right now in Syria trying to dismantle that arsenal of chemical weapons.
Chemical weapons, along with nuclear weapons and biological, are considered taboo for good reason. These are weapons that are indiscriminate. They kill women and children and innocents, as well as those on the battlefield. And that's why they are in a special category. Again, diplomacy appears to have won the day. We shall see. But I really am heartened that the Syrians, under a great deal of Russian pressure, have agreed to have all the intrusive inspections, and they will continue. They'll destroy this program. It can be done. I mean, the United States, we signed the Chemical Weapons Treaty back in the early 70s, and they need to join the League, the international community of nations, in saying we are no longer going to allow chemical weapons.
But what did you and your husband Joe Wilson, sitting there in New Mexico, think of the use of the intelligence gathering apparatus to make the argument for a military strike in one case, and then for diplomacy? I mean, did you feel as though the government's learned their lesson to not turn the intelligence gathering apparatus into a political operation, or which you both got sort of caught up in?
As Joe and I watched this very carefully and closely from our home in New Mexico, we felt, I think, like the vast majority of Americans. We were absolutely fatigued of military ventures. We've had two wars that have dragged on much longer than we've been told. The first one, Iraq, which we were very much involved in, turned out to really the intelligence that got the American public to support that war turns out to have been indeed twisted and manipulated. What I think we have to give credit to the American people in that they looked at these possible options, as horrific as those pictures were of women and children on, you know, the floors in Syria, and the terrible human cost of that all. I still think the American people said, oh, wait a minute. If we go in, what about the day after? We understood. It's not like Assad and his regime is on one side and the good guys on the other. To the contrary, we really don't know what's on the other side.
Which leads to this idea of blowback, the title of your book. I mean, blowback refers very precisely to the idea that intelligence in one era can come back to haunt you in another era. Do you think you've lived that experience? And in some ways, is this book a cautionary tale for Americans about what is a successful mission today could end up creating all kinds of problems down the line?
I chose the title Blowback because when I first heard it when I was working in the CIA, I didn't know what it meant. It's such a vernacular term, and it speaks to unintended consequences. If you're considering and calculating an operation, what are the blowback potential for that? And so as the book as a cautionary tale, it what I really wanted to do, the genesis of it, was to show a female CIA operations officer that wasn't just a paper doll. There's real substance to her, that, and it's not just this lone wolf character that we see so many times in popular culture.
So do Americans in this book see Claire Danes or see Valerie Plame in this character of Vanessa?
I think Claire Danes is a wonderful actress, and I'm riveted by Homeland like everyone else who tunes in. But it is unrealistic, again, that if you notice, she doesn't have many friends. Mm-hmm. You know, it would be her character, Carrie, and Jazz. And in real intelligence work, it's pretty important to have high EQ, good interpersonal skills, because for all the fancy spy satellites and the things that they sort of hype up in terms of technological ways of collecting intelligence, it comes down to the human relationship and trying to find that trust and getting someone to collect intelligence on behalf of the United States policymakers to hopefully make wise decisions with it.
Do you miss the whole Langley world and is working with a co-writer different than working with your handler at the Iran desk?
I miss my career. I don't miss the bureaucracy for a moment, of which there is plenty. But I love my job. I got to pursue something that I thought was extraordinarily satisfying, trying to make sure bad guys don't get a nuclear weapon. But that chapter is over. And working with Sarah Lovett has been great.
Finally, if you do write another novel, you got to put an Edward Snowden in there, right? I'm interested in your reaction to all of this just turmoil that's been caused by the Snowden operation and our view of intelligence and surveillance right now.
Indeed. I've watched this very carefully unfold, that constant tension between security and privacy. I am not prepared to say or take a stance on whether Snowden is either the hero whistleblower or a traitor.
Really? See, I would have thought you would have said, I want to nail that guy.
Well, without his information, without those revelations, the American public would not be having the conversation that President Obama said we really should have about the extent of NSA surveillance.
Listen to you. Right. Valerie Plame, author of Blowback, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
So now, at the end of the hour, a reminder of what we're dealing with here. A nationwide government shutdown so a minority voice in the House of Representatives can be heard on an issue they insist represents the majority of the country. Is that how it's supposed to work?
Congress doesn't just have to end this shutdown and reopen the government. Congress generally has to stop governing by crisis. They have to break this habit. It is a drag on the economy. It is not worthy of this country.
President Barack Obama says no, it's not supposed to work this way. Newt Gingrich, though, former Speaker of the House and architect of the last shutdown in 1995, says this is the way it's supposed to work.
People tend to forget this is not, you know, a crisis. The House is elected independently, the Senate is elected independently, and the President's elected independently. This is by design. The Founding Fathers wanted to force, literally force, all three to deal with each other.
Well, what those framers wanted exactly is unclear to us nearly three centuries on, and it's certainly difficult to say if they envisioned this precise scenario that we're seeing this week. But built into the Constitution is this free society, a delicate mix of rule by majority and the protection of minority views from being overwhelmed by that majority. It's deliberate, But is that tradition being played out here or distorted in some way? Joining me now, Jeffrey Stone. Jeff is a professor of law at the University of Chicago. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Delighted to be here.
I notice you've blogged on this, and without sort of preempting the discussion here, I know you're pretty critical of what's going on in Washington right now, but can you sketch out for us the tradition between minority rule and the protection of minority rights and minority debate in the U.S. Congress and the Constitution for us?
Well, there are many ways in which the U.S. Constitution sets up our government so as to enable minorities to have a reasonable say in the political and legislative process. The entire scheme of checks and balances and division of authority, separation of powers, having Congress, the House of Representatives with two-year terms, more or less local representatives, the Senate with six-year terms, staggered, representing larger political entities, the states, the executive, of course, being elected through the Electoral College. All of these are designed essentially to avoid the dangers of an overbearing faction, in the words of the framers, but majority, perhaps, in today's words. And so the system is certainly designed to ensure that minority views are reasonably represented in the process. On the other hand, it's not meant to ensure that minority views get to dictate the outcome. And so that's a fine balance between the two. And so my own view is that it's extremely important that the government operate in such a way so that the different views are heard and listened to and taken seriously. And it's another thing entirely for a group, whether the minority or the majority, to paralyze the government, to hijack the government in a way that essentially betrays the premises of our constitutional democracy in order to use threat to bring about political change. That, to me, is completely illegitimate.
I'm talking with Jeffrey Stone, professor of law at the University of Chicago. You can see read his views on House Republicans and what he calls the betrayal of democracy at the Huffington Post, where he blogged on this subject. You know, there's been a lot of language and a lot of colorful metaphors. I'm going to push those aside for just a moment, because there have been people who have said in frustrated tones this week that the responsibility of the government is to function. Now, does it really ever say that in the Constitution, that is the responsibility of all these systems, the executive and the Congress, to actually settle things and move forward? Or is the responsibility to make sure that stuff gets debated and that things get considered in an appropriate way, due process, these kinds of terminologies?
Well, both. But of course, in this instance, there's no argument that can be made in any serious way that there's been an inability to debate or discuss the issues about Obamacare. The bottom line is this is something which the House Republicans have presented repeatedly in the Congress and lost. They challenged the constitutionality of the legislation through the courts, and they lost. In the 2012 election, they made this a central part of their campaign, and basically they lost. They're free to continue to do that. I mean, that's the essence of American democracy. You can argue and keep arguing and try to persuade, and maybe eventually you can win the process. You go back to the people, you say, throw the bums out, elect enough people who will do what we want to do, and we'll do it. That's American democracy. American democracy is not to say, if you won't do what we do, we're going to shut the government.
And we may see in 2014 in the election some voters actually making that point. But I'm wondering if there's an argument to be made that the idea that it is up to Congress to give permission to the executive to spend money, that there's a constitutional question there. That, I mean, there's really nothing preventing the executive from basically saying, no, we're gonna keep the government going. Go away. I mean, there's an authorization process, there's a budget process, but the idea that they can shut things down by this sort of permission business, that could just go away, right?
No, I think not. I mean, I think that's built into the understandings of our constitutional structure, is that the president does not have the authority, except perhaps in a genuine emergency, to make independent funding decisions if they have not been approved by the Congress.
But if it's the status quo, they've already been approved, haven't they?
The bottom line is that the president does not have the legal authority to continue to spend money after this date without a continuing congressional resolution. And for him to do that would raise very serious constitutional questions.
So it would have to be a constitutional amendment, and that's, you know, sort of the line item budget sort of, argument that, passes through Washington periodically.
Right, or a finding of a genuine national emergency, and I that's not the case at the moment. But the bottom line is that it's simply this. The House Republicans have not been able to win in the electoral process, in the legislative process, in the judicial process. And what they've done is basically taken out a gun and put it to the heads of the other elected representatives of the government and said, if you don't do what we're going to do, we're going to pull the trigger. That's not persuasion. That's not debate. That's not deliberation. That's not the American democracy. That's the use of extortion to coerce change. If there's one thing that we are completely united on in American history, is that the use of coercion to force people to act in a certain way is limited only to those circumstances where it has been legally authorized. And that's not the case here.
Is there a way to challenge the Speaker of the House not calling a vote on this, even though there may be a majority in the House to actually pass it if you add up the Republicans and Democrats? Could that be challenged?
Well, I mean, the Republicans in the House can refuse to comply with the Hastert rule, which is idiotic. Basically, there's no question but that the continuing resolution would pass the House if everybody were free to vote. The problem is that they've tied their own hands within the House.
Right.
And but you know, the double irony here is you can't even say that the House agrees with the House Republicans. Right. There's clear a majority of members in the House who would, left to their own devices, who would vote to move forward.
Now, that's amazing. Jeffrey Stone, we have to go, but thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
His views at the Huffington Post. Jeffrey Stone is a professor of law at the University of Chicago. What do you think about all of this?
This is Marissa from Staten Island, and I think it's the sign of a dysfunctional system. I think it's a sign that the importance of government on people's lives has become too extreme. It should not be too big to fail.
Or from Columbus, Ohio, democracy can be messy when parties become captive to uncompromising ideology. What do you think? Thanks so much for listening to our program. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.